You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman, here with my co-host from Bitch Talk, Angela Tabora. And this segment, we're going to talk about the documentary premiere section film, Miss Americana. We have with us the director, Lana Wilson. Lana, it's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Tell us what Miss Americana is about.
Well, Miss Americana is about a little-known singer-songwriter named Taylor Swift as she goes through a transformational period in her life.
You know, one of the things I think is wonderful about, I mean, there's a lot. This is the first film that Angela and I saw. Mm-hmm. We're still talking about it several days later, to your credit. But, you know, the film in many ways is about her growth, and you would go, well, the obvious is because she started at such a young age, so of course it's about her growth, but it's actually about the growth of her willingness to use her voice and her comfort with doing that, which I think was amazing. And I would like for you to start off talking about, as the filmmaker, how you decided to frame her story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, when I first met her in 2018, kind of early 2018, she was just coming out of being away from the public eye for a year. And she was coming back into the public eye, but she, you know, is someone who realized that for years she'd been living for public approval, and she wanted to change that. She wanted to kind of reconstruct her whole belief system and start to be not the person who everyone wants her to be, but the person who she wants to be. So basically, I started to witness this evolution of her political feminist consciousness in this incredible way. And that was what felt the most relatable and compelling to me as a director as I watched this unfold. So that was what I wanted to make the spine of the story. But it started with me having a lot of questions and curiosity, and the story emerged through the filming.
Yeah, that was one of the things that was so interesting to me, because you see this dichotomy of her since she's 13 years old, mm-hmm. writing music, playing music, and essentially pouring her heart out into these songs. Mm-hmm. She says at one point, it's like opening my journal and reading a journal entry. So she's so open about her feelings, what she's going through. Yet at the same time, she needs this approval, and she's not unsure of herself. So like really confident in this one side of her mm-hmm, life mm-hmm. and just really so, like the opposite spectrum in this other side. So mm-hmm. it was really interesting watching that battle within her.
Yeah. No, she's someone who has always expressed the full range of emotions and with such candor and specificity and brilliance in her songwriting, but in her kind of public-facing life, in part because she's under more media scrutiny and pressure than almost any person on earth, I would say, and in part because of the particular expectations of women and girls, who I think mm-hmm. are often expected to be nice, seek the approval of everyone, mm-hmm. not make anyone uncomfortable with their points of view, in part because of those social expectations. It was like a leash was on her in a way. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I got to see her taking the leash off.
Yeah, I think there are many wonderful moments, but one of those wonderful mm-hmm. moments is her sorry, not sorry moment.
Yes. That's my personal favorite.
You know, I mean, it's just great, the thing of like, why am I saying I'm sorry? Talking about in my house that I paid for with the songs that I wrote about my life from my diary.
You know, it's so good.
And isn't that relatable?
Yes.
I mean, I say I'm sorry about like 1,000 times a day. Mm-hmm. I've had to just stop beating myself up about it. I'm just like, that. I'll try, but I'm also not going to beat myself up about constantly saying sorry, because that's what women are trained to say constantly. I apologize to the door when I bump into it, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, yeah. And when it comes to really, like, she's such a public figure, how did you gain this trust from her to let you see these intimate sides of her that we never have seen before?
Yeah. Well, part of it is that she had seen my previous work. So I think she understood me as a storyteller. I mean, I make films that are often about people living in extraordinary circumstances, and films about subjects that have a lot of headlines and perhaps sensational sound bites attached to them. And I try to show the complexity, the gray area, mm-hmm. and I like to give the audience space to come to their own conclusions. So she really mm-hmm. responded to that storytelling style and had some trust for me as a director because of that. And then the other part of it is just taking time. Yeah, she hadn't done an interview in 3 years. No one had ever filmed her writing songs in the studio before. So that was just a matter of building up the trust over the days of shooting.
Yeah, let me give you a quick shout mm-hmm. out for your earlier work, because After Tiller, just a sublime film that takes one of the most such a difficult, complex subject, and I had it at several of my festivals that I'm part of.
Oh, great!
And and so it's important to remind people about that film.
I appreciate that.
The other thing that I want to talk about, which I think is wonderful about this film, is showing her as a working artist. Mm. And there's so many scenes where we actually see her, watch her write a song with her music supervisors or producers taking their cues from her, trying to keep up with her as she goes along. And we rarely see that.
Yeah.
And I think it's remarkable that she allowed you to do that, but so important because she is a writer.
Yeah.
And we forget that.
First and foremost. Yeah. I do think people, especially people who don't really know her music or her very well, I think people might have the misconception that she's a pop star with a giant machine behind her. And what I saw was could not be more different than that. I saw one extraordinary artist who is creatively in charge of every aspect of her songwriting, the ideas, the aesthetics for the albums, the music video, in this way that I found thrilling to watch as an artist. And she has been writing songs since she was 12 years old. She's written every song she's ever recorded, which is extraordinary. I mean, I think she's one of the greatest songwriters of all time. And to get to see her in action is really a gift for any creative person or not creative person, to just learn from the mix of work ethic and being able to catch those moments of inspiration when they come. Because, you know, anyone who I think is a writer or a filmmaker or anything, you know, if the moment of inspiration comes, you have to catch it then or it goes away and you forget about it. Mm-hmm. So it's, I love watching that stuff.
Yeah, I have to say, I didn't know a lot about her either. And I really gained this new level of just respect. She's the last of this dying breed of these artists that do everything and touch everything. I love that part when she's thinking about her ideas for this music video.
Yeah.
And then you just kind of see them side by side actually coming to fruition.
Yeah.
It's really powerful. But I also love that, as John said, she's just kind of running the show and telling these men, you know, like, keep up with me, let's go. Mm-hmm. And I think for somebody who claims to, you know, her self-esteem was always an issue, like, I think once she realized her worth, like, you know, then, and because we see that strength throughout the whole thing.
Totally. We're all trying to move through the world, feel confident with ourselves, be true to what we believe in. And I feel like I got to witness her gaining this incredible courage to say what she believes in a new way.
Because it was there all along.
Yeah, of course it's there all along. Mm-hmm. Totally.
And in the lyrics, you know, I was thinking about this afterwards, you know, and the Ken Burns documentary series on country music. Mm. What was fascinating about that is that country music fans can, at a moment's notice, recite a lyric almost like they're reciting scripture. And, you know, and so I was thinking about her, you know, because we do think of her more as a pop music artist than a country artist, but she falls within that realm of someone whose lyrics literally, I was saying, you know, yeah, Kris Kristofferson into Dolly Parton, into Taylor Swift, you know, lyrically there is art there.
Yeah.
And again, that's something that you illuminate, you know, in the film. My question also is that, again, there's so much trust that has to be had behind a filmmaker, and we've touched upon that a little bit. But there's also, as a documentarian, sometimes you take on this burden of responsibility for the person that you're profiling. Mm. And I would love for you to talk about that, because, you know, this is not your first rodeo doing that.
Yeah.
But talk about your thoughts, you know, as you go through the process of going, I need, this person's trusted me. I need to tell their story the right way.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, and it is for any subject. You're asking yourself, I need to honor the trust this person has put in me and capture some fundamental truths. I mean, that's always what it is. You can't get every aspect and shade of a person into a 90-minute film. It's impossible. So you have to think, what is the theme? What is the story I want to tell? And what is the fundamental emotional truth of what this person is going through? So in order to figure that out, for me, it's a matter of first while shooting, and then while looking at the footage in the editing room, just noticing what I respond to, where you have those bizarre moments of self-recognition in the situation of someone who, on the outside, could not see more different than you. Noticing that. Mm-hmm. Because if you're feeling that stuff, the audience will too. And for me, at first I thought, you know, I wonder what I could possibly have in common with one of the most famous people on earth. But in the end, this felt like one of the most personal movie-making experiences I've ever had.
Mm-hmm. I think at the same time, another thing that I really took from it, and I'm hoping other people do too, is with social media, how quick we are to judge people.
Yeah.
And you didn't speak up soon enough, or you spoke up too soon, or, mm-hmm. you know, letting the fact that people need space to breathe and process something, mm-hmm. and let me just think about something before I just word vomit my immediate emotions. The fact that we judge people so readily, mm-hmm. I hope that people take away from that you know, the pressures that we all have, even as normal citizens, let alone as someone famous.
Oh, yeah.
And the notion that, like, writing one wrong thing can make or break you is just so ridiculous, mm-hmm. and unfair.
It's so true. We are living in this Twitter soundbite world where we judge things in this very black and white way. And, you know, you don't get clicks by writing a nuanced headline.
Yes.
Not at all. Mm-hmm. And it's true what you say, that we are all living in public now. We're all putting ourselves out there, constantly conscious of who likes us or not, of how we measure up. And in that way, I saw the stuff that Taylor was dealing with not as just a celebrity challenge, but as something we're all dealing with, but on a massive global stage.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and we're going to be wrapping up soon, but I also, but following up on that, another question I had was, you know, you could have easily in... And you're so far beyond this, but in that behind the music kind of style, you could have gone through the relationships that we all know, because of course, as someone like her, you know, we know all the relationships, but you pointedly don't, and in fact, you know, I don't even know who the guy was that was there, and which I loved. I love the fact that, you know, that you kept the focus on her and we didn't devolve in that, but. Talk about your intellectually what you were thinking.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's like, this is a woman who she is 15 years before she became famous and 15 years of her career. I didn't want to make like an illustrated Wikipedia entry of her life. And I didn't want to retread ground that's been widely covered in the media already. Mm-hmm. I was like, what do people not know? And so the criteria for me was, fundamentally, this is the story of a good girl deciding to speak out. Anything that is backstory or that is context has to relate to that. And, you know, as far as the role of her relationship in the film, I'm glad you appreciated that. Mm-hmm. She has had so many relationships go through the private ringer. She's in this relationship now that she understandably wants to keep private. And so I really wanted to respect that while also being able to have a moment that does indicate the significance of this relationship in her life in a way that you can feel emotionally.
It was finessed very, very well.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Again, the film is Miss Americana in the documentary premiere section at Sundance. And we've been talking with Lana Wilson, the director. It's been great having you here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Listening to the Festival Daily Buzz, and I'm your host, Angela Tabora, joined by my co-host, Lancia Wan. Right now, we'd like to welcome on the show from the documentary premiere, Happy, Happy, Joy, Joy, the Ren and Stimpy Show, we have co-directors Ron Cicero and Kimo Easterwood. Thank you so much, guys, for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So I guess we'll start with you, Kimo. Can you give us an introduction to Happy, Happy, Joy, Joy?
This documentary is about a cartoon called Ren and Stimpy that came out in the early 90s. That was a cultural bomb, you know. It upended the animation world as everybody knew it up to that time. And we just thought it was a great... A friend of mine had told me about John Kay, the guy that created it, but I had never seen an episode of the show before we started this documentary, and Ron had only seen one episode. So we weren't fans of the show. So when we first set out to do this documentary, we had to actually start watching episodes.
So you went through a lot.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if you both weren't fans of the show, what started the interest in making and producing this documentary?
You know, it was actually Todd White who previously worked with John Kay on a series after Ren and Stimpy, had introduced the idea to Chemo, and I was at a point in my career that I was, my soul was dying. I was doing lots of commercials, and it just got overwhelming. And so I called Chemo up. We've known each other for 25 years, and I said, "Look, let's do something creative. Let's go big. How about a feature documentary?" And he's like, "Well, Todd's got this idea." And so we did about an hour's worth of internet research and came across both a very passionate audience, but also just nobody had touched on this before. The show had only been on for a couple of years, yet it had this huge ripple effect across popular culture, TV, animation, and we're like, I cannot believe nobody has done this before. So immediately we were intrigued. I will say, if you're going to spend 3.5 years of your life on a project, maybe you take more than an hour to make that decision. But that's the beauty of being first-time filmmakers.
Well, that's funny because I loved Ren and Stimpy. I grew up watching it. Cool. I bought the comic books. So when I saw that this was on the list for Sundance, I was like, we have to get them. I haven't even seen it yet, but we have to. So awesome. That's so funny that you're coming at this. So what were you thinking? Because you're watching it from a different pair of eyes. Like in the 90s, of course, this was revolutionary.
Sure.
We never saw anything like this before.
That's
so
right.
What were you thinking after, you know, all these similar types of cartoons have come out since then?
You know what? We had perspective, I think, because we're, you know, a little bit older. We're just past the time when Ren and Stimpy was breaking for people in college. So we understood that, you know, this was the early 90s. This was before, you know, digital took over production of most animated shows, if not all. And so we had a real appreciation for the kind of handmade quality of the show, and knowing that, you know, what was around back then. And that's something certainly we cover in the documentary, that this was the first time in many, many, many years that this style of animation, this amount of care went into a cartoon. Because before that, it was, you know, for the last 20, 30 years before Ren and Stimpy, they were glorified TV commercials. Really, if you look at animation, even, you know, John Kay, the creator of Ren and Stimpy, talks about how awful Scooby-Doo became, you know, animated-wise. We have a nostalgic affinity for it, but ultimately, if you look at the animation, it was pretty crude based compared to Ren and Stimpy.
And Chemo, you came from a tour photography background, having shot like Christina Aguilera, Bon Jovi, Usher, ZZ Top. What about the project sort of drew you outside of that, outside of Ron saying, hey, let's do something creative with Todd?
Well, I mean, I had moved from stills to motion years ago. So I had been shooting short documentaries. So I don't know, going from stills to short documentaries was just a natural transition, you know, to me, because I've always loved film, and so I thought I'd try my hand at it, you know. And so that's, so I'd already been shooting short form documentaries, so this wasn't the first time. This is our first feature length full blown film, but before that I had just done like little 5 minute, you know, 7 minute documentaries on interesting people or whatever. And I just love the format, so that's kind of and I also was looking to do a project that was going to be a little challenging, you know, something that was going to be different, that I didn't know much about, you know, and we both were kind of in the same boat. And so like, let's just jump in both feet and do it.
So why not start with a topic that you guys were more familiar with rather than a topic that,
you know, that's a good question. And I think actually by not being familiar with the show, we could look at it from a distance. You know, if you're a fan, and when I say that with the truest sense of the word, it's fanatic, is, you know, what fan means. So if you're a fanatic of the show, which we've met plenty of those types of people, you're going to get really into the weeds. And with a documentary, it's its own thing. It's its own movie. It has to have its own story, its own narrative arc. So you can't get too in the weeds with an kind of an educational exercise on the show. Yes, we touch on lots of elements in the documentary that explain how extraordinary it is, but you know, that has to be interwoven in a story. Otherwise, people are going to be snoozing, especially if they're not fans of the show, you know? So that's why it's actually better to have that distance and then dive in, as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah, I want to turn now to John Kay, the creator of this. after being a fan of the show, I knew nothing about him, but after being a fan of the show, it kind of makes sense that he would be a very eclectic, interesting sort of guy because of just the real psychological, mental, emotional core of the cartoon itself. Right. So can you talk about meeting him and really pulling behind the layers of onion peel that you found?
Yeah, so I'm not sure if you're aware, but we actually finished a movie, a completed version of this film without John, and it was a celebration of the series. Other people spoke about John, so you get to know him through archival, etc. And then the news broke in BuzzFeed, the Me Too
I was going to ask, when did you finish this movie?
Yeah, so the film was done, and then the news breaks, and we're like, oh my God, what are we going to do? This movie's toxic. How can you talk about this series and not address these issues? Well, when the news broke, fortunately, John then changed his mind, decided to speak with us on camera. It still took 6 months of sitting down with him, getting to know him, having lunches. He's a big UFC fan. I did Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I still do. So that was a commonality. And then, you know, also having Robin Bird be generous enough to sit down and explain, you know, a very painful part of her life. So with regards to John, it was just finding common ground. And look, as a documentary filmmaker, you need to have empathy for your subjects, no matter how awful of behavior they've exhibited in the past. So that was really important. And our film presents the entire story. We don't make proclamations on how you should feel about the show because of John's behavior. And that was really important to us.
I was wondering from the beginning to the finish, I was like, when are we going to, because you see Robin for a minute.
That's right.
Talking in the beginning.
That's
and then
right.
You just sort of wait for that climax. You're like, you're bracing yourself.
I was
waiting
ready.
For it to hit.
Yeah.
And you're like, when are they going to start talking about that story?
Sure.
It was really difficult. We went back and forth in the editing room months.
A lot. Yeah.
Trying to figure this out. And we had her in a lot in the beginning. And then, you know, we had to screen this thing. And people would be confused because she had nothing to do with Ren and Stimpy. So there would be, you know, people would be like, who is this person? Why? And so we went back and forth of putting her in, taking her out, peppering her in, taking her, you know, and just trying to figure out the right way to do this transition.
Yeah.
And everyone thinks that, you know, like, you should have just done this or what. You have no idea how difficult it is because sometimes it just simply doesn't work in the editing room. You just have to go with what works. And this is the way we feel worked out.
Absolutely.
For us.
You know, because again, she wasn't a part of Ren and Stimpy, and this is talking about the creator. So on the flip side of that, in terms of a narrative arc, you can't just pop her in at the end. People are like, why should I even care about her? And, you know, who is this person still? Mm-hmm. So we introduced her in the very beginning, and then midway through, I don't want to give it away, but so you do start to go, okay, who is this person? And then, you know, it pays off in act three.
Well, I really commend you because I can only imagine the lump in your stomach dropping when this happens. And you've worked on this film for however many years.
Yes.
Blood, sweat, and tears.
Yes.
And then it's like, what do we do? We can't just
That's
toss
right.
it. And you really came up with a product that was really great and gives
Thank you
all the different sides.
Thank
and,
you.
And I think it's a really important conversation to have. It's just this role of, you know, these media creators and how do we separate them from their work or how do we reckon with this? Because nobody's perfect. We all, you know, and I think that's a really important conversation to start.
Yeah.
Well,
I was just going to say, the other part of this too is just in terms of perfectionism and trauma. I mean, that's also something that we explore. And you have somebody, and we say this many times in the film, that John Kay was completely obsessed with cartoons. Wakes up in the morning, thinks about it, goes to bed, thinks about it. When we first met him, he sat us down to watch a cartoon. That's how we initiated our relationship with him. And when you have somebody that's that obsessed and they have talent, they're going to create something great, but there's other areas of their life that are going to atrophy, and that is personal relationships for John. And that all comes, that perfectionism comes from his childhood trauma. Like, I want to be known, I want to be loved, I want to be discovered. So even though John has done some terrible things, we want you to come away from this movie going, okay, like, why did this happen? And more importantly, how can we prevent this from happening again? And Robin has this line of like, look, you can experience pain, but you don't have to inflict that pain. So it's a much bigger issue than just, you know, a Me Too movement, which obviously is extremely important, but this is something that's going to carry on for years that, you know, we're always going to have to, unfortunately, deal with until we eradicate trauma, you know, and that's, hopefully that happens soon, but...
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and most of the fans know of all the talented artists that worked on the show. So,
that's a great point.
You know, it's they can separate it because they know that not every episode is John.
That's
right. A lot of episodes are Bob Camp and Vince Waller and all these other amazing guys that did it. So they can watch a show and still enjoy it.
That's right.
Knowing that there's so many people involved in making it, and it's not just this one guy doing this thing.
That's right.
You know.
For a little perspective for the audience, you mentioned that it was a 3.5 year project for the both of you to come up with this movie and shoot it, and I'm assuming redo it almost when the news hit in 2018. So it probably started in 2017, is that
2016.
Correct? 2016.
Yeah, in the very beginning when we were doing a little bit of research, and we tend to, you know, in this project, I mean, this is our first project, but what seemed to really work for us is to do some research, but not over research, because you really want to go in there and ask those questions that are going to elicit the response that are going to be part of your narrative, instead of going, well, I know that already, and then you forget to ask it or you forget to incorporate it in the film. So a lot of our research was just through interviews, and we did, what, 50 plus interviews?
52.
Was a lot of that research also watching the cartoons? Because a lot of those scenes matched up with what happens real life along those timelines.
Yep. Yeah, in the very, very early days of researching, we were actually pulling names, just watching episodes and freeze framing it on the credits and going, oh, there's that guy. We gotta get that guy.
That's right.
You know, we didn't know any of these people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, now they're friends of ours. You know, they know us, but we didn't know who, you know, Vince Waller was or any of those guys. Yeah. So we would literally freeze frame and then just write those names down. And then just one by one, we just started to try to get a hold of them, you know. Yeah. And
that's great. Yeah. Well, we have to wrap up, but in closing, what are John's thoughts?
John's thoughts?
Has he seen
the film? Has he seen it?
He hasn't. We offered to show it to him, but so far he's declined, but we'll see what happens.
Interesting.
All right, cliffhanger. On that note, thank you so much for being
here
again.
We've
been speaking to Ron Cicero and Kimo Easterwood of Happy Happy Joy Joy.
Thank you so much.
The Festival Daily Buzz is brought to you in partnership with Films Gone Wild. You can find more info at filmsgonewild.com.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and KCPW.org. I'm your host, John Wildman. With me is one of my teammates from Bitch Talk, Angela Tabora. And right now we're going to talk about some animation outlaws. We have with us Kat Alyoshin, the filmmaker, and Spike Decker, who of course is in the film. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So Kat, tell our audience, what is Animation Outlaws about?
It's all about Spike and Mike's Festival of Animation. And they started with classic animation and, of course, went into the sick and twisted genre. But it just starts with showing, I have 65 clips in this film of the shorts that they showed in their program. And just talking about how a lot of the people out there now, that the animation directors that we all know, people like Pete Docter and Andrew Stanton, how they got their start in this program.
We have the shorts, we have the filmmakers behind the shorts, and we also have the circus of the presentation of those shorts. And it's great to have Spike here on the show, and having seen the promotional wonder that Spike Mike was. So Kat, how did the project come to you? Why did you decide, you know, this is the story we need to tell right now?
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to work for them back in the 80s. So I was one of those flyer boys. They called the girls boys, too. So a flyer boy, yeah.
What
so
kind of costume did you wear?
Well, they call me Little Drummer Boy. So he also calls me Irish Tripperama. But just on the street doing those flyers, like they're so good at all that promotion. I mean, thousands of flyers. We hit up college campuses, wrestling matches, whatever was out there. If there was a line, we were flyering. But so, and then at that point, a couple years passed. I got into animation. I'm into stop motion animation. I hooked up with Spike a couple years ago. And the story needed to be told about where these guys had come from and how many people they had supported and promoted in
Mike's
this
the dead one
in the 40-year in the 40-year program. So yeah, a lot of support, and I just wanted to tell the story.
All right, so Spike, this is your story. I mean, you, and anytime someone turns a camera on you, or you know, or says, you know, we're going to do the history of what you did, and you know, there's always emotional feelings that come up about that. What were your feelings about the film being done, about Kat doing the film? Let's talk about that.
Oh, Mr. Trump gave me a whole bunch of money, and I'll testify. No, I'm sorry.
Oh, wrong interview.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll testify. No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Wait.
All right, talk about, you know, you've had a film made about you,
right?
And about what you guys accomplished. And so what were your feelings when at starting this project and having the project actually being done after all this time?
Okay, well, we had I had three other people that wanted to wanted to do it, and we were in San Francisco, and she brought it up, and I've known her forever, and I trust her. So that right there, for the main thing was trust her. Right, that was the deciding factor beyond any of these guys, and so then she put her own time and money into it, and I know she knew Mike, which was really monumental in the whole thing, and. Grew up in the same city and this history already there. So it's pretty amazing. It's also, this sounds funny, but I'll throw out the quote Trevor was making fun of. It's a quote for Jerry Beck gave us. He's one of the world's leading animation historians. It's like Spike and Mike came from nowhere with nothing and created a market where none existed. Mm-hmm. And so to qualify that, the point I'm gonna make is like she put also her own money into it. Which personally, to me, in response to your question, is monumental, because all our life we've been doing stuff for people, and nobody's ever done anything like that for us. Actually, the most respect I ever had at a festival, personally, was from Michael Moore at his festival in I think it was Michigan. Anyhow, sorry, I got off on a tangent.
No, that's great. I love how throughout all of this, you know, starting with nothing and then watching it grow into this monumental thing, you still stayed true to your roots. You never gave into mainstream. You never played in specific venue. You know, you kept it really, really rogue. And can you talk about how important it was to stick to that message and never really sell out?
Wow, good question. yeah, it's really hard. I think that's why Michael liked us so much, Michael Moore. But it's been really hard to do it independently. It's still really hard. That's the other thing. And I think it's just where we came from and where I grew up and what I was around. And at first, like, it was like we had a friend that got in a motorcycle wreck and insurance. And he lost his leg and he loaned us $1,000 to do our first show we did in 16 millimeter at Riverside City College. And so to be able to pull it off independently, that's all we've ever known. And like movie, we didn't play theaters because, not being a major corporation, the game was they wouldn't pay you unless you had another blockbuster film as a hostage. So they literally would not give you your money unless you had that next film. And then they go, well, we're not going to give you the next film and all this crap. And we weren't that major studio. So we would go in and four-wall or do performing arts centers just to try to survive and go on to do the next one. So it's still really hard. And personally, I guess it's just, I've been just a different kind of bird my whole life and the places I've grown up and stuff. So I never could. You know, it's just like you see in the documentary, one of the things, like I was a paper boy for 5 days when I was this little boy, and it was so screwed up, and getting up at like 5:30 in the morning, I'm sitting there folding papers. I'm going, this is so effed up that if I have any talent in this life, I'm going to do it so I don't have to get up early in the morning. So there you go.
And you did it.
You know, one of the other joys of this film is seeing almost the upbringing of animation babies who became giants. And Kat, can you talk about that, about reaching out, you know, to those people, the Andrew Stantons and the Pete Doctors and people like that. And I have to assume they were delighted to be a part of it.
Absolutely. That's a great assumption. I am very fortunate that nobody said no. I mean, anytime I said I'm doing this documentary about Spike and Mike, they're like, we're in. When do I go? Where should I be? So very excited, a lot of excitement about telling their stories of how these guys helped them out. You talked about the event and how great it was when you go to these shows, but they brought animators to the shows and had them, made them feel like rock stars, had them do autographs, sign the posters, talk in front of all these people. And that's just not something animators are used to doing. And then I was there with some of those people back in the 80s, early 80s. Being in animation as well, I started on Nightmare Before Christmas is my first animation piece. I started to get to know all these people in animation. So also I had access. That's where I got a lot of I could just call them up and say, hey, Andrew, will you be in this film? So I was very lucky.
Yeah, I love that this is a project that's, driven by the artist, not the industry. And that's why I feel like it has such staying power, and it holds dear to people's hearts. So when you ask, like, oh, do you want to be part of it? Of course they do. Yeah. And I wanted to ask you, Spike, how it felt to, feel like a misfit. You've said this was your way of making statements against a society you don't fit into. But realizing that you're actually part of a majority, slowly all these people are it spoke to them and it just grew. And so how did that transition feel for you to, feel kind of like a misfit, like you didn't belong, and then realize that you found your tribe?
Part of that, it's really good, especially going to cities that we didn't even know anybody and becoming like the main, like San Francisco. We roll in there and we don't know anybody, and we end up being the event that weekend at the Palace Fine Art of the Castro Theater. And going to Annecy, another country, and these kids from all of these countries, and then they loving the show and the brand and stuff. It's pretty exciting. The frustrating and the, I guess, even sad to me personally part of it is that still to all we've done and all the doors we've opened for so many people, I've seen very little of reciprocal of the two-way street. I've seen the cars go, and that's something I would still hope would happen in my life, that maybe just once something would open for us. And it's frustrating to go, people that don't know us, and like I did an interview and the woman didn't know anything, and she's like, it's like history. I'm like, where do I start? Do you have 5 hours, And it's like the people know who we are and what we did, and to get respect for that. And still, it still seems, maybe I'm old school, but it still seems like you have to be able to break through somehow to the quote mainstream and the Joe Citizen to where they know, or and I'd still like to be able to do that, because it's hard personally to look at something or you see somebody else getting a payday or the respect for something and you go, oh wow, where were you 20 years before when we were doing that? And they're getting the juice, and you're like out on the outside looking in.
Well, the wonderful thing about this film is that it shows us where so much of that juice came from. Again, the film is Animation Outlaws. We've been talking to the director, Kat Alyoshin, and Spike Decker, who's in the film, of course. Wonderful to have you guys here.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Festival Daily Buzz with Bitch Talk Podcast on KCPW and kcpw.org. I'm your host, John Wildman, joined on this segment by our show's producer, Alancia Wan. And on this segment, we're going to talk about the midnight section in Sundance, the film Amulet. And I'll have our guests introduce themselves. Let's start with you.
Hi, my name is Carla Urey.
My name is Romola Gary.
Hi, I'm Alex Sacarano.
So we have our director, our writer-director, and two stars. And Romola, why don't you introduce our audience to the film?
So Amulet is a gothic horror about a young man, Tomas, played by Alec, who is living kind of down and out in London. And he is fortuitously kind of rescued from the streets by a nun, played by Imelda Staunton, who kindly gives him a place to live in a sort of dilapidated house, which is lived in by a young woman called Magda, played by Carla, who's looking after her elderly mother, who is sort of trapped in the attic. And they start to fall in love. He wants to help her with the dilapidated house and potentially rescue her from an abusive relationship with her mother. And then at a significant point in the film, you realize that all is not quite right in the house and with the mother, and the film takes a supernatural turn.
All is not quite right is an understatement. and I want to start off this way, because this is your feature filmmaking debut. As a director, as a writer-director, and you have a lot of credits behind you as an actor. And so I wanted to start off with you talking about going on the other side of the camera for a film like this, which it's a stunning debut. But what you bring into it as an actor and then turning the tables on other actors. Talk about that.
I think it wasn't an obvious first feature for me. My short film, which was in Sundance, was a drama. And, you know, that was definitely my familiar territory as an actor. Those were the kinds of films that I made as an actor. I wasn't experienced in the genre territory as an actor. But horror films are some of my favourite films. And they are and have always been a really big part of my my experience as a viewer is towards more visceral kinds of filmmaking. So I think when I came to write features, the ones that I initially wrote, which were more in the drama sphere, I mean, they went into development and I, you know, had progress with them. But perhaps they didn't quite sort of set me alight in a way. And I think when I wrote this film and it was written very quickly in just 3 weeks, and I showed it to a producer and it was picked up immediately and went into production a year later, like it was all very quick. I think it came from, you know, a really deep sense that I had something that I wanted to say. And you know, and it was easier for me to do that in a very aesthetic, visual, extreme kind of language, which was a stretch for me because it wasn't, as I say, my background as an actor. But I loved working with our team, our amazing sound designer, cinematographer, and actually I think I ended up making a film which is not typical of an actor's first film because it relied very heavily on those other departments and we collaborated very strongly. So that was kind of the journey.
Right. Well, and I want to get Carla and Alec in this because, you know, both of you have worked with different directors. And sometimes directors are more technically oriented. Some of them are much more comfortable framing than they are working with actors. But when you're working with a director who has been an actor, then they understand actor angst and they understand communication that you need. So I would love for both of you to talk about that. You know, what Romola brought to this in that realm. Alec, let's start with you.
Well, being a genre film, you have to do some very technical stuff from time to time, so you don't have that much liberty to play with in the scene. But this is where Romola came in, and she tried to make me comfortable with doing some stuff that I had to do then, maybe to push more or less, and I totally trusted her, because sometimes you get the feeling that in this kind of genre film, in horror film, that you might be doing too much. So Romola was there just to tune me in and just give me courage to go further and push, and she really knew when to push me and when to keep me down. And well, I think this is the specificity of this genre, that you have to do, like, really, it was a lot of 2 centimeters to the left, 2 centimeters to the right, but in the end, all it paid off because it really looks good, and the story stands, and
And Carla, it's not just another actor, but it's also a female actor, you know, who's also, you know, able to, you know, to communicate with you or and help you through that process. So again, let's hear your viewpoint on it.
I guess there was like a hands-on approach on both sides. That was nice. There was no awkwardness that sometimes can happen because you don't know your directors for a very long time before you dive into shoot. So it can be a bit disconnected sometimes. But it wasn't at all with Romola. I don't know if it's her quality as a human being or it's just an actor as well. Or, I don't know. I think it's a mix of also her personality, who's very giving and generous, and I felt like, for sure, maybe I felt like I could ask her more if I didn't know what's going on also with me, because I would feel all kinds of things, and maybe I would be more open to her about, be more transparent to her about my process than maybe I would be with a director who is not an actor. So I'd share more secrets with her, yeah, definitely.
Right. Now, producer Matthew James Wilkinson's called it a feminist horror, and he talks about how Romola had the experience to sort of bring gender politics into this film. And Romola, I know you sort of took a break from acting, went back to school, because of a lot of turmoil that was happening within Hollywood, and then you sort of came back for the suffragette because you had a very passionate... trying to think of the word, but passion for that film, and things kind of turned tables a little bit. Did you take that sort of experience and kind of put it onto set? Did Carla and Alec, did you kind of see those, the differences when working with her versus other filmmakers?
I never gave up acting. You know, I finished my degree concurrently with acting in my 20s, and then I did take a break, but that was to have children, so it wasn't... But I don't think that my level of kind of rage about gender inequality was made any higher by Me Too. It was already very high. It was already turned up to 10. But I think what happened was that I started to see other women pulling gender politics into the genre, and was then inspired and felt more able to do so because of that. I'm sort of specifically thinking about, well, Raw had already come out by the time we were sort of in development, but certainly The Babadook, and you know, when you start to see those kind of themes coming in, I think that made me feel like the story I was telling was more acceptable and potentially more accessible to audiences.
You know, and we've had a previous conversation, and I promised not to ask you the same questions that I've asked you before. But I was really impressed by the conversation we had talking about the influences on past films, and I would like you to talk about The Tenant especially, and you know, and how that colored you know, your approach to this film. I would love for you to talk about that.
I love The Tenant. It's one of my favorite movies. So when Laura and I, my director of photography, sat down initially, that was one of our key references. We didn't have the house at that time. We knew we were going to have to shoot on location. We didn't have it yet. Ideally, we would have liked a slightly bigger house. but I think we just talked an awful lot about windows. We talked a lot about different kinds of contours, different kinds of glass, and my production designer was able to come in on that and use different kinds of glass in the film. There's lots of mirrors, obviously. We've got like refracted glass. There's a lot of framing in and around windows, and also just this idea that somehow a man's sort of mental kind of derangement or denigration is kind of being played out in his environmental space. The only set we had was the attic, so that was the only kind of completely controllable space we had. But actually, the fact that the house was a location made it feel even more sort of spooky and grounded. I know that you guys basically had to spend 4 weeks like sitting in that house getting more and more depressed and thinking more and more like, maybe this wasn't a good idea.
What's too late to pull off.
What did we sign up for? That's
it. Yeah.
You know, so we haven't talked about, and I'd really, let's talk about Imelda Staunton, because it's such a fun performance, and you know, and every character, but all the three characters in this film go through really dramatic changes, and hers has kind of a twisted joy to it. In fact, I was kind of thinking of Ruth Gordon in Rosemary's Baby, talking about. But talk about working with Imelda.
I mean, I just would come up and say things, and you know, and I'd say like, "Oh, maybe you could do it like this," and then she'd be like, "Yeah, or maybe this," and I would go, yeah, that's actually better. I mean, you're working with an actor who's so much more experienced than you as an actor, and so in tune with every element of the thematics of the emotional story and the technical craft of acting, you know, like it's embarrassing as an actor director to come up to an actor and say, could you do it again, and also tilt your head slightly to the left, you know, it makes you very conscious of yourself to ask that. And she just did not mind, because she is such an experienced actor. She could accommodate every single technical requirement and still do her job and still like do Oscar winning acting, and it was, and she was just incredibly experienced and also very, very brave, because, you know, her character goes through something of a kind of a transition which is a bit humorous. There's an element of kind of dark humor to that, and I think there are definitely actors who would be very afraid to do that, myself included, I think, you know. So and I know that you guys had positive experiences working with her, I think.
Well, that's, I wanted to jump into that, like, especially Alec, because there's quite a bit of interplay between the two of you. And I have to think, as an actor, when you get to work, you know, with someone who has so much behind them, like Imelda, that there really is just almost like a giddy, I'm playing in the sandbox with someone that I've watched do all this stuff.
She was super generous, to be honest, and she was very funny, and she's very good at steaming off the tension. I remember one day she told me, I mean, we had so many jokes between the takes just to steam off the tension, and she came to me one day and she said, okay, so when the camera gets closer, do more. So, okay, thank you for that tip. I remember that. No, she was really, really great to work with, really great, and she was so funny and generous, and yeah, we had a great time, yeah.
Well, again, you know, this film, I'm so much a fan of the film, as I've expressed, I've kind of been obnoxious expressing that to the three of you. Again,
you don't mind.
Okay. But it really is. It's a stunning debut, and the film is Amulet, screening in the midnight section at Sundance. We've been talking to Romola, Carla, and Alec. It's been wonderful talking to you. And that's a wrap on today's edition of the Festival Daily Buzz on KCPW and kcpw.org. This show is made possible with partnerships with the Slam Dance Film Festival, GoTo Productions, and KCPW Radio. In-kind donations are provided by Pro Bar, Keto's Brewing, and The Market, Park City. Our audio producer is Charlene Godo. Social media help was provided by Shoshana Howard. And assisting us in production are Chris Gardner and Brian Silverman. Our executive producer is Lancia Wan. Thanks for listening.